Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. And we're very happy to have back with us once again Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practiced here in our area for a long time. She has been a resource for listeners stopping by on a regular basis to talk about women's health. Now, we've talked about a lot of different things, and if you have a question for her that deals with that area, you can call and discuss that with her, and she will do her best to give you an answer. Always when I have physicians on the show, I just caution people that there's a limit to what we can do talking to people on the phone, but this should be a good information resource for you. So if you have questions, call us, and we will do our best. And then she usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new in her field, and we'll do that. And if you have questions, you can certainly call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You can also send an email if you'd like to pass your question along that way, and that is willtalk@illinois.edu. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad to have you here. I know that there are probably a number of things that you would like to talk about. There was one big thing, one pretty big thing that's been in the news recently that we were sure that you would want to talk about.
Okay. Good.
And that was the changes in the recommendation for pap smears.
Absolutely. I have the entire 26 pages of new guidelines right in front of me.
I see.
In case I need to don't have it quite all committed to memory, but it... Yes, they've been changing quite a bit, and this time the changes in the recommendations are quite radical. And at the very end of this very long document by a number of groups that have gotten together, they do say that it's going to take a bit of time before patients, their providers or their healthcare providers, and their insurers to all get on the same page, really understand how to best apply these new guidelines in every case. I thought I would talk a little bit about the fact of screening in general and how we reduce disease and how once we've reduced disease down to levels like this, we can back off on our screening recommendations and even continue to improve health. Whereas the first thing that most patients will think about is, well, if I get fewer pap smears, am I more likely to slip through the cracks and not get my cervical cancer diagnosed? So that we do know that in the 1950s, we had a fairly high rate of cervical cancer, and it is still a very important disease. Worldwide, about 500,000 cases of cervical cancer are diagnosed, and worldwide, 250,000 women each year die. But we have less of a problem in the United States, and we probably have in the range of 3,000 to 4,000 deaths of cervical cancers each year. And of the cervical cancers that we diagnosed, over half are people who have either never had a pap smear or no recent pap smears in, say, 5 to 10 year range. Mm-hmm. So when we start talking about improving the rate of detection of cervical disease, the first thing we need to do is pick up those women who haven't been screened or inadequately screened. So most of these new recommendations are not for those people. Most of these new recommendations are what we normally think of as the average American woman and what we are offering her. In between the 1950s, before, and then suddenly after we introduced pap smear testing, we reduced the rate of cervical cancer in the United States by 70%. And if you get screened, you are very likely to have precancerous tissue diagnosed if it exists and then treated, and then it does not go on to become cervical cancer. Having said that, I will say that if you get the most advanced forms of precancer, the CIN3 or cervical intraepithelial neoplasia 3, which is equivalent to carcinoma in situ, even if you're treated, about 1% of those cases will go on to have cervical cancer over the next 20 years. So we have to, again, separate out people who are being screened and people who are being treated or diagnosed. So just to give you an example, say you go to your doctor, you have no complaints. A little bit different topic, just to give everybody an example so that even the guys will understand what we're talking about here. But if you went to your physician and said, hey, I feel perfect, and they check your blood pressure, they may find that it's high, they may not, but that blood pressure exam, that's a screening test. That's a screening test for hypertension or high blood pressure, and you had no complaints, but they checked your blood pressure anyway because it's a screening test, and it would be probably appropriate for the average person walking into their physician's office. On the other hand, if you went in and said, I have headaches, I have double vision, you have some symptoms, I feel really tired, now they take your blood pressure. It's not really a screening test any longer. Now it's part of that workup of your headaches. So same too with pap smears. If you've had an abnormal test in the past, now when your healthcare provider suggests pap smears or suggests a frequency of pap smears, now we're treating cervical disease. Those people are siphoned out of these new changes, which are changes to screening, meaning the healthy person, she has no symptoms, she has no reason to believe that she has an abnormal pap smear. She's walking in for healthcare screening. If we continue to screen women over the age of 65 all the time for abnormal cervical changes, we will save one or two cancers per 1,000 women if we keep screening to age 90. And of those one or two cancers we might find per 1,000 women, most likely, as women age, they're going to die of something else. They don't need that early abnormal pap smear treated. So the new guidelines are very radical in saying that women don't necessarily need a pap smear anymore after the age 65 if they've not had previous disease and if they've had adequate screening up until that time. Now, we are offering HPV testing, human papillomavirus testing, along with pap smear testing for many individuals. And we're now thinking that HPV testing along with that pap smear, rather than being a reflexive test that we only use in abnormal cases, but using that as our first line to get both the pap smear and the HPV test will help us determine if the patient has had adequate screening. So it's a different pap smear than women may have had before, although many women have had both tests. So that is one of the ways that it has changed. In addition, we've been focusing on testing patients later on. So when I was a teenager, the recommendation was to get your first pap smear at age 16. Many of us know that we were starting pap smears at age 18. Now the first test, age 21. But more focus is being focused on the individual that is 30 and older. Because between 30 and 65 is when we find the most cervical cancer. 21 to 30, we find precancer, but much of that precancer is never going to go on to become disease. Even if a patient has CIN3, that carcinoma in situ that I said even treated, 1% will become cervical cancer. Untreated, about 30% become cervical cancer. So 70%, if we don't treat, will not have a disease that will kill them. So the focus has now been on treating patients to prevent invasive disease and saving patients from undue repeat testing, invasive testing, extra treatments to their cervix, if that's not going to actually prevent invasive cancers.
Okay, so we're questioning whether there's a point for doing testing over 65. We're saying that your baseline probably should come when you're 21. But now in this critical period between 30 and 65, where previously we might have said women should be tested every year, or possibly then we got to a point where we said, well, if you had a test and it looked good, maybe we'll let you go 2 years. So now what are we saying about how often you should be tested in that 30 to 65?
There are two groups of patients, one that's been adequately screened up to a point of time, and between 21 and 30, we would like you to get tests every 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
Once you've had two, some doctors will say three negatives, between that 30 and 65, patients can jump to every 5 years to actually have the pap smear.
Yeah. See, now, I would think that women might be worried that, okay, so maybe you're going along fine. But what is, when you get to this point where you're going to go 5 years, what is the point that, you know, the possibility that you might get a test, you get a false negative, so you have cancer, but the test comes back good, and then the doctor says, oh, you look good, we'll see you in 5 years. What's the possibility that in that 5 years that you're going to develop cancer?
So you've been talking to too many doctors, and you obviously know what a false negative test is. So when you get a good report that the test did not show a disease,
right,
a good report in medicine is a negative test.
Right. Okay.
A little bit of a misnomer there somewhere along the line. And we have tests that are accurately negative and tests that are not accurately negative. Pap smears are notoriously higher rate of less likely to be accurate, but these HPV tests added in with the pap smear reduce your chance of false negative significantly. So we will have people with a normal pap smear, but possibly a positive HPV. So in the old days, that would have been a false negative, but now it's not. It's a normal pap smear, but a positive HPV. And actually, that's where a tremendous amount of the research is being done to understand that. It turns out that even patients who acquire a new partner, possibly pick up a new HPV type, will still not progress far enough along in the acquiring of HPV and the changing of cells into precancerous changes to be in jeopardy of having disease that is untreatable, even if we look very far out. Now, I have to say that I'm not part of these guidelines. I'm part of many of these big studies and actually part of the writing group on looking at some of the data out of a couple of these big studies. But beyond that, on a personal note, we have very few American studies, really none, that we can look at and say, well, let's look at this group of patients that only got pap smears every 5 years here in the United States. How did they really do? In the Netherlands, however, they have been doing this every 5-year testing for a long time. So there are places we can look for information as to the safety. Plus, I do urge patients to get their accurate history. One of the biggest problems we have in the United States is, how do you get the history? You go to one doctor, your health plan changes. A couple years later, you go to another doctor. Our medical records don't always talk to each other. When I'm talking to patients and say, have you had a normal pap smear in the past? I'm relying many times on her recollection as to what that test was. So I think that's where there are going to be some issues.
Well, so okay, let me ask you a different question. If you take a look at women who had not had a pap smear at all, say,
yes,
is that more likely because they don't have access to care, or is it because they just didn't think that it was important and just didn't do it?
Well, there are studies that look at that, and access to care is very important. Cost is important. There's absolutely a certain percentage of population that did not want to do it. There is a certain amount of education that is necessary at a young age. Many people are not aware if and when they need pap smears, so we have to get that education. And depending on the individual circumstance, she may or may not have had that education. So there are many factors, but probably funding looms the greatest as an issue.
Okay, so it's maybe more likely a care issue rather than access to care issue rather than a woman just not either not wanting to or not thinking that it was important, or maybe just thinking, yeah, one of these days, you know, I really do need to do that, and it's not.
There's
happening.
Some of that, and fear, not understanding what the test may or may not show. There's also in the United States been a linking between the Pap smear, the pelvic exam, the provision of contraceptive services that all seems to be muddled in people's heads as one and the same, and they're not.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, let me ask you a different question, a related question about human papillomavirus. We know that human papillomavirus, or at least some, there are a bunch of them, and some of them have been implicated in cervical cancer, and that is why we are now recommending that young women be vaccinated, and we have this vaccine. Having said that, though, suppose that we went out and we could test every woman enough so that we know we got a representative sample. How many of them would test positive for some kind of human papillomavirus?
So we think there are low-risk viruses and high-risk viruses. Okay. And there are somewhere between 100 and 200 of these viruses. There are probably a couple of dozen, maybe three dozen of the low-risk types. And there are about a dozen, 14 or 16, but 14 is usually what we think of the types that are the more serious, what we call the high-risk types. At any one moment, we could have 40 million Americans testing positive for a high-risk virus. But if we retest that same group in 6 months, 2 years, many of those people will go negative, and some new people will acquire the virus. If we test college students when they enter college, if we round up a group that is not exposed at all, by the end of college, in some studies, 70% are testing positive for the HPV virus. And these people are moving from age 18 to 22, so the vast majority now won't even get a pap smear. Some will leave college long before they get pap smears. So we know that many people who are young will acquire these infections, but our immune system can fight them off. And we do clear these infections, and they don't necessarily go on to become invasive cancer. But as a viral load in our population, it's big, and vaccination is only just now scratching the surface. The United States, we do not vaccinate the way they have in Europe, Australia, a few other places. We have maybe 30% of the at-risk population getting vaccinated. And we still have too many people getting vaccinated after they've started sex, and they've probably already been exposed to the HPV virus. And our vaccines only carry two of the most serious virus, 16 and 18. And as we move forward in time and get better vaccines, which are in the process of being developed, we'll probably hopefully have some studies for our regional area coming up soon on some of these newer vaccines. But as we move forward, get boys vaccinated, get more females vaccinated, get better vaccines, we can look at the vaccine to reduce the incidence of disease down low enough where we can factor that into our pap smear scheme. Yeah. But we don't yet because we haven't done well enough yet with the vaccine.
Well, the vaccine now has been available for how long? Maybe about 5 years?
Yes.
And has been perhaps somewhat controversial, or at least there have been questions about at what age would you recommend that it be given, and that the first recommendation was for it to be given to girls. And I know we have talked about this a lot. A lot of people said, look, we should give it to boys, too. We should give it both boys and girls. And I think it finally the recommendation finally
yes.
has been made that, yes, boys should get it, too. But so we're only a couple of years into the vaccine even being available. Are there some projections on how long it would take before we even get to 50% vaccination rate?
Well, there are no real projections that I've exactly seen for the entire country. We think that pockets of the country are already getting 80%. Mm-hmm. Communities, little pockets. Whole states getting to 50% is probably doable in the near future, but even our entire population getting to that, it's going to change. It's going to take some change in thinking, and we really, to be able to get the 50% that we want vaccinated, it's going to be 50% of 9 to 12-year-olds. Even after 12, we start talking about, quote-unquote, catch-up vaccination. So between 12 and 26, many people have already been exposed because any contact can expose you to that virus.
Well, and it's an expensive shot. So, again, if people are not being vaccinated, is it because people don't think that it's important, or it's just because it's really expensive and not everybody has insurance and not everybody gets covered and not everybody can afford it?
In states where there's statewide coverage, the vaccine rates are improved. We think that the other problem is that you need to get all three doses to really have that long-term coverage. So the first two doses are really your coverage. Your third dose is your booster that gives you that long-term coverage. And as people change insurance plans or move or go off to college, now the next dose is due. They may get out of sequence. They may be uncertain what they're supposed to do when they're out of sequence for their shots and fall off, not get that third dose. So there are a number of considerations to effective vaccine program.
Yeah. Are there any recommendations for adults, people who have been sexually active for 5, 10, 15 years and more, have had more than one partner, about whether or not somebody like that, is it worth them being vaccinated?
There was a study done, and I actually participated in a vaccine study of women between ages of 25 and 45. And for that group, a significant percentage of patients had been exposed to the HPV virus, but most were not exposed to all four components of that virus. And it was protective, but as a strategy, public health-wise, the FDA ruled that there was too much pre-infection to make it part of the package indication. So individually, patients do get the vaccine, but it's never covered by their insurance and not part of the general overall strategy.
Okay. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist, has a practice here in our area, has been with us for a very long time on a regular basis to talk about women's health. We have someone with a question. Others are welcome, whether it's about this or anything else, as long as it's within the area of women's health, you're certainly welcome to call. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here is a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I saw something that somebody had passed along on Facebook. It was somebody had written a column about losing two friends to oral cancers that were HPV-related, and the problem being that you don't feel the cancer. If it's not picked up by a dentist, for instance, you can go undetected until it's too late, and apparently these are very difficult, aggressive cancers, or can be. And so people who think of this just being preventing intercourse-related, traditional vaginal penis intercourse, preventing that sort of infection transmission, are missing the fact that some people use this contraception, they use oral sex, and instead of having vaginal intercourse. So another point to mention, and another reason for boys to be vaccinated as well.
It is a good point. We also think that the HPV virus is implicated in certain respiratory conditions, and it is a very effective public health strategy to get all of us vaccinated young enough so that this disease is controlled. And again, even with the head and neck cancers, the vaccines probably need to be improved. They now have component 16, 18, 6, and 11. 6 and 11 are primarily low-risk viruses that produce warts, and that is a disease that is worthy of control, although those warts do not go on to become cancerous. And 16 and 18 tend to prevent the cancers. With the kind of antibody response we have, we will fight off two or three other very important HPV types. And those types are important for the head and neck cancers as well. But we still need to improve the vaccines to get enough coverage. But you're absolutely right. There are many diseases prevented, not just we talk about cervical cancer because we have the pap smear and everybody knows about it. But we're actually preventing vaginal cancers, vulvar, which doesn't speak to what you're pointing out. It doesn't have anything to do with sex. But the most important cancers that we're preventing besides cervical are still vaginal, vulvar, anal, probably some urethral cancers as well as in the men, some penile cancers.
Well, I thank you for the call. Other questions, comments, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You mentioned the fact that, now you're when you do a pap smear, you're also testing, doing an HPV test, and that having the two, doing those two things together gives you more information than you had if you were just doing a pap smear alone. Is that now, has that become the standard?
It's not really become the standard because insurance companies are not necessarily covering that testing and not everyone is selecting for that testing. And the cost can be fairly dramatic if we don't do, if we add in that test and you have an insurance company that isn't covering it. So right now, floating out there, there are three or four strategies. One is pap smear alone. And if someone 30 to 65 is just getting pap smear alone, she should probably at least stick to the every 3 year strategy rather than jumping to the every 5 in spite of her prior history. And in the other strategies, getting the pap smear plus HPV test. And then what's sort of circulating in the background is what they call primary testing. Just get an HPV test, not the pap, because the HPV test itself is a little bit more sensitive for high grade cervical precancer. But we don't have a good strategy that all doctors agree on. When you have a positive HPV test, but no pap smear to rely on. So pap smear plus the HPV test is a better test than just getting the HPV test. And it's something we're trying to move our patients to. Like I said in the beginning, getting the patient, the doctor, and the insurance company all on the same page, because very short time ago, insurance companies used to audit us if we weren't doing pap smears every year on our patients and say, hey, you're low on the list here.
You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing.
What you're supposed to be doing. So now we have to be sure that the insurance company is on the same page with us. And if we don't offer our patient a pap smear for 5 years, they're not going to put us on the blacklist. But the wheels have to move.
Yeah.
We have to change. We have to get everyone reading these guidelines and understanding them and understanding which patients we should now apply them to.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Suzanne Troopen. We're talking about women's health, something that we do on a regular basis here. We will talk more after a very short break. This is Focus.
After Sunday's long-awaited season premiere of Mad Men, fans of the show will be eager to talk about it. On the next Fresh Air, we talk all about the new episode with executive producer Matthew Weiner, who wrote it and created the show. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible with support from The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will be talking with the ambassador of the EU to the United States. His name is João Valle de Almeida, and he will be on this campus a little bit later this week. He'll be talking with us tomorrow morning by telephone. We'll talk about the EU and its current economic and political health. Also tomorrow, we'll have some more conversation, again, carrying forward from what we're talking about this morning in the first hour about affordable and public housing in Champaign and Vermilion counties. Tomorrow morning at 11, we'll have the executive directors of the Champaign and Danville Housing Authorities here with us in the studio. This is a part of a series that we're doing in cooperation with CU Citizen Access, and we'll also be doing a live television program tomorrow night on WILL-TV. You can also listen to it on the AM and watch it online, talking about some issues dealing with housing, particularly with access to affordable rental housing. And that's tomorrow night on WILL-TV. We are here weekday mornings from 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to the website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. In this hour of focus, we are talking about women's health. We do this every other month on a Monday. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area and for a long time has been a regular guest on the show. Questions are welcome. We've been talking quite a bit here about pap smears in the first part of the show. If you want to ask a question about that, you certainly can. But anything else that has to do with your area of practice, you can give us a call, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. I'm curious now because this is this change in the screening for pap smear makes me think about the continuing raging debate we have about screening for prostate cancer. And maybe this gets us into some other areas too. It had been for a long time. I think it's still the recommendation that men should be screened for prostate cancer starting when they're 50, and that we should all get this blood test, the PSA blood test. And then the recommendation, I think, is you should have the test every year in addition to having a physical exam by going to see your doctor. But there again, there are questions about, well, particularly given the slowness with which prostate cancer develops, whether that's really worth what it costs, worth the anguish and stress that might come if you get a false positive test. So if someone tells you you have cancer but you really don't, then you got to have biopsies, you got to go through a lot of other stuff. And a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, this is just not worth it. Are we moving a time where you think, well, there'll be more and more of what has been routine screening in the past will say, we're not going to do as much of it, or we're going to go longer between tests?
So a lot of interest is in this subject. What we want to do is test the people that are high risk for certain diseases and then spend money testing the people who are not at high risk for this disease but some other disease, and focusing our healthcare energy, dollars, effort, however you want to say it. So looking at any given test and applying it to every single individual in our population probably is going to be a thing of the past, just like we do not get cholesterol testing on every young person every year.
Although some cardiologists think we should.
Okay, that's a different topic.
I know. Sorry.
If we see you going into McDonald's, you will be getting a cholesterol or something
well,
like that.
Take
Don't,
your license plate number down.
There are plenty of things you can eat at every fast food place that's perfectly healthy, so can't condemn any particular one, absolutely. But when we look at your example of prostate disease, if the prostate gland gets enlarged, you have other compromises and symptoms, and it may be that enlargement, whereas it is precancerous, but the true benefit to you is going to be to have a normal-sized gland that will not interfere with urination or pain or any other physical activities. And that's where perhaps just doing that screening exam and feeling the gland might be as effective for treating that complaint as a blood test, which may have lots of ups and downs. We also have improved the testing a lot. For instance, female testosterone testing, not a cancer screen, but we did female testosterone blood levels for the management of certain gynecologic complaints for many, many years. And suddenly, within about the past year or so, they realized that that test had been powered for male levels of testosterone. And the test really wasn't sensitive enough for the slight ups and downs in the narrower test range for female levels of the hormone, and they completely switched the test. So most likely, if you had a testosterone test done in a lab many years ago, it's not the same test that they do now, and it's not as accurate. There are other tests that we've improved as well. Even these HPV tests are continually being improved, and one thing these guidelines point out is that some HPV tests weren't very accurate. So that the false negative, false positive rates were too high in the older tests. Going forward, we would like you to get a test that's considered very accurate and FDA approved. There are some tests out there that are not FDA approved. But many doctors don't even know what their laboratory is using. They send a test off, they ask for HPV, it comes back. They may or may not be completely savvy. It's probably on the form in some fine print, but they may or may not be completely savvy as to what their laboratory director has decided to use as an HPV test. So that's where pathologists are helping gynecologists and primary care providers behind the scenes by establishing a plan to do HPV tests with these newer, better tests that we've had in the past. So it's quite complicated.
Other questions here are certainly welcome. We have about 12 minutes here, a little bit more, with Dr. Troopman. If you have a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller on our line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Can you hear me? I'm on a cell phone. I hope I don't break off.
Sounds fine. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. I have a question about menopause. I know I'm getting off your topic, but I am 53, and for the last couple of years, I've been having some hot flashes, and my period seems to show up like once a year, but it's only like for the last 2 years, only like minor spotting for a couple of days. And so I have two questions. Basically, I guess am I in menopause? And the second question is, my hot flashes have stopped. Is it because I'm still spotting, or is it just a normal thing that they disappear like that?
The formal definition of menopause has not changed, and it's still one full year with no actual period. A gynecologist might tell you those few days of spotting may or may not have been a period. They may have been some other kind of bleeding. We've redefined women who have these irregular periods, and when you go worth your cycle off by more than 7 days, which yours is certainly off by more than 7 days, over a long period of time, 2 to 3 months, that is the first sign of menopause for most people. And once you cross over that threshold, for most people, their ovaries producing very little estrogen. We've also discovered that as women age, they will occasionally ovulate. And if they occasionally do ovulate, you may have a stretch in time where you're producing enough estrogen that your hot flashes are being self-treated by this little bit of estrogen your ovary is still producing. So that probably doesn't give you an exact answer. You, by definition, are in perimenopause, by definition. Your ovary probably is not producing a lot of estrogen over this long period of time. The vast majority of people will resolve their hot flashes in 2 to 5 years, so it certainly could be you have passed into that time frame. But occasional ovulations are possible, so in the short run, if you've recently only not had hot flashes, it may not be that you're not going to resume having hot flashes, but that your body's making a little bit of estrogen.
Okay, always people speak about the perimenopause and postmenopause. Menopause seems to be like a point that seems to happen in between the two. And so I never really know when menopause occurs. It's just you're in menopause for a while.
They have a very fancy set of definitions that we mostly use in research study called the STRAW guidelines. So the stages workshop is essentially what those initials stand for. And they define these periods of time leading into and leading out of the FMP, the final menstrual period.
Okay.
So until you go that one full year with no FMP, you aren't technically crossed over from the perimenopause into menopause.
But once I have stopped having a period for over a year or spotting, don't I become postmenopause?
We defined after that specific time point of menopause, once you get years out, you become postmenopausal. Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is someone in Roanoke on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Oh, I want to talk to the gynecologist.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I am 82, soon to be 83, and I've had a complete hysterectomy, and I was wondering, should I still have the pap smears every year?
For women?
Necessary.
The quick answer is no. So for women who have had no high-grade cervical disease for the past 20 years, they do not still need to be screened if they are over 65 with or without a cervix. And if someone does not have a cervix after their hysterectomy and they have not had abnormals leading into that hysterectomy, they no longer need pap smears either. Your gynecologist will probably want to do a pelvic exam and a visit. There are other things they're going to be looking for, but they're not going to be taking that pap test.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Very good. And we'll go on to another caller, and this is someone in Urbana. This is line 2. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for always having this service.
Mm-hmm.
I am 67, and last year when I went for my yearly pap smear, my doctor said that he thinks that I only need it every 2 years. Now, I missed the very first part of your discussion on what the new laws are and what insurance is covering. But my question is this. I happen to be the daughter of a mother who took DES while pregnant, and I have read some indication that possibly I should insist on having pap smears every year regardless. What is your opinion, and what does insurance think about this?
Every insurance company is somewhat different, and as far as I know, no insurance companies have really weighed in on all these newest guidelines. Also, we do separate out the well people that have had no history that is important, and we are applying these what we call screening guidelines from the people that have had previous cervical disease or other exposures or risks that would make them different than the screening population. And we do not think that DES exposure is really in that same category as the completely low-risk screen. And I would think that most physicians would say their DES-exposed patients have to continue some sort of screening, even very far into the future. I'm not current with, just off the top of my head, I haven't seen any recent changes with the guidelines with respect to DES patients. There is a DES registry, and I think it's always been managed out of the University of Chicago, but it's in the Chicago area. I think you can find it on the web, and they usually have the most updated guidelines for what they recommend in terms of DES exposure. But I would agree, you're in a different category than the average person that is being screened.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Other questions are certainly welcome. And again, we'll be here for about another 5-6 minutes. If someone wants to dial up real quick, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu.
So we haven't really talked about DES in maybe ever or a long time, but it's initials for diethylstilbestrol, which is an estrogen. And many years ago, literally in the 1950s, 60s, they thought by giving high doses of this compound could prevent miscarriages. It turned out to not be based on accurate research, but there was a group of individuals who were exposed. And after the mother took that medication in early pregnancy, the daughters, actually the sons, had some abnormalities as well, but it primarily affected females. The daughters very often were born with either abnormalities of their cervix or their vagina, and they would develop a condition called adenosis, vaginal adenosis. And basically, instead of just looking like a smooth muscle wall, the vaginal tissue looked like it had little bumps in areas. It was pretty easy to look at with the naked eye. And that tissue was more susceptible for developing cancers. And as we're talking about this, I haven't really seen so much that links it with HPV. It was a totally different mechanism. Although knowing what we know now, probably did have some relationship or does to HPV disease. And those cancers were in a very young age. I think the peak age was something like 28. Very, very, very young. Mm-hmm. And we've known not to give DES for many, many generations. So many young doctors never seen a case of adenosis. But birth control pill exposure early in pregnancy, inadvertent birth control pill exposure early in pregnancy, theoretically could have some of those same consequences. So it is something that we do rarely still see, but many of the individuals are much older who were exposed.
Well, you were talking about a situation where a woman is using oral contraceptive, but she gets pregnant anyway, but she doesn't know that she's pregnant, so she keeps taking her pills?
Luckily, with over-the-counter pregnancy tests, we don't see it very often.
But it sounds like it has happened.
It's happened.
Okay. Is there now? We've spent a lot of time talking about, and for good reason, because this is really big, very big in the news recently. The new recommendations for PAP smear. Anything else that's been in the news, or anything else that you've been reading about you'd like to talk about?
Well, there's been quite a bit in the news regarding polycystic ovarian condition and what is the best way to manage these patients. We know that they have more difficulty with acne, with hair growth, with irregular cycles, and then ultimately with infertility. Once they are treated, they also have increased risk during pregnancy. And there's been a recent study showing that a much higher than average percentage of women who were polycystic ovarian condition, when they become pregnant, they are more likely to become gestational diabetics. And there's also a study now saying that even after pregnancy, it's much more likely their gestational diabetes is going to persist. So we try to get all patients who were gestational diabetics in pregnancy retested 6, 12 weeks out after their pregnancy and then into the future. But this group of patients requires extra surveillance and extra methods to make sure that they don't persist in their diabetes diagnosis.
Okay. We have another caller here. We'll see if we can get them in here in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have a question. But first, I must apologize for my complete ignorance on this subject. But perhaps you can settle the dispute. My significant other and I have been having a rather heated debate about this. She had, she's 50 years old, had an ablation about a year and a half or two ago. And for the past year, she's only been spotty in terms of her menstrual cycle. And she claims that as a result of these two factors, no concern should be spent on birth control. And I, from my limited knowledge of what I read, I think she's completely wrong. What do you think?
So spontaneous pregnancies after the age of about 46, 47 are pretty rare in general. But of women still ovulating after the age of 50, in some studies, about 50% of the cycles can be fertile in some way. So most gynecologists will recommend using contraception until you've passed into menopause. With an ablation, you lose that automatic signal as to when you've really passed into menopause, unfortunately. With being age 50 and having an ablation that destroyed the lining of the uterus and having ovulation so rare, I would agree with her that conception would be remote. but I would agree with you that remote doesn't mean impossible. And until she's formally passed into menopause, we recommend contraception.
Mm-hmm. Does that get at your question?
Okay, I just don't know who's going to buy the next dinner now. I'm not sure who won.
Flip a coin.
You'll just have to share the tab, I think. And again, so for a woman to be considered to be postmenopausal, is that a year no periods?
A year no periods. We can do some blood testing to show that the FSH level is elevated and that the estradiol level is very low, and those are biomarkers of the menopause. Once you've hit into that and you are the right age and you're having menopausal symptoms, it's pretty accurate that you wouldn't be ovulating anymore and wouldn't be fertile. Mm-hmm. Formal definition, 1 year after that final menstrual period.
And what sort of things other than a menstrual period or an extremely light period might result in a little bit of bleeding? I mean, and is that something that a woman should be concerned about?
It's difficult to say that a little bit of spotting is something to be concerned about if you're at the appropriate age for menopause. Probably track your cycles and talk to your own healthcare provider. Once that little bit of spotting becomes too frequent, we can't just chalk it up to a single ovulation, and an ultrasound and pelvic exam might help figure out what's exactly going on, because there are a few conditions that could cause that.
But in terms of you generally, and I guess it's probably because of cost, you don't routinely check women's hormone levels just to see where they are if you don't have any other good reason to do it.
You don't generally, because about 10% of people can wax and wane and go into that really early menopause based on their hormone levels, but then resume cycling. So we try to discourage people checking just because.
Yeah, okay. Anything else that you just might like to mention?
Average age, I would just say on this topic, the average age of menopause we used to think was 51. The newest study that just came out relatively recently said that the average age in the United States is more like 49 and a half. So we think that we're moving down to earlier menopause.
Well, we're also
US.
Moving down to earlier date of first period as well. Are those two things somehow connected?
The earlier date of first period has to do with obesity and rapid growth in youth. This earlier menopause, probably due to other factors, and smoking is one of them. Yeah. Smoking produces an earlier menopause.
Okay. Well, at that, we'll leave it for this time around with our guest. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen, obstetrician, gynecologist in our area. She's here every other month. It's always on Monday. We talk about women's health. Thanks very much.
Thank you.